So I'm Laura Scuriatti. I come from Italy, but by now I'm almost a Berliner because I've been here for 18 years. I have a background in the study of languages and art history. So I took my degree in Milan at the Università Statale in modern languages, and I studied Anglo-American literature, German literature, and I took lots of courses in art history and aesthetics. When I studied, people were allowed to basically design their courses, their undergraduate courses, as they wanted. There was very little, there are very few constraints. I explored various disciplines. I took lots of courses in history, a few courses in philosophy, and then I decided to devote my attention, apart from the courses in literature that I had to take, to art history and aesthetics. And this has been a characteristic of my research as well, and of my teaching. I've always tried in everything I did academically to connect art history, also architecture or architectural theory, to literature. And as I studied, I developed a love for modernist literature and art. And so my dissertation, my undergraduate dissertation, which I wrote partially in Milan, partially in Britain, in London, because I was doing research in the library there, was on the relationship between post-impressionist aesthetics and the British novel. It is interesting that, considering the developments of philosophy and art in at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, a question that doesn't seem so, I mean, that seems very, I mean, seems fundamental for, say, somebody writing a novel, namely the question of how to represent time, especially the time that is not mechanical, but it's the time of thought, the time of consciousness, and how to represent that, and how in an art form that, according to some traditional view, is about time, because it has a time structure inbuilt in it, because we read in a sequence and we take time to read, as opposed to, one could say, painting, which is based on space and on simultaneity, so it and the fact that it is one thing that cannot depict time in any way. So this is a moment where time begins to, because of various reasons, take up the space that space used to have, and begins to, in a sense, begins to be a focus and to be an object of inquiry for so many people. And even in the novel, where we're used to think of time structures in terms of story, plot, development of characters, and so on, we find that the interest is an interest emerges in a time that is not a sequence, that is not measurable, that is not mechanical, and that is in a way ineffable, in the sense that it is and it's invisible as well. You cannot communicate it, the time of consciousness, the time of thought. And at the same time, we see that in a few art movements, we see that time begins to enter the artwork as a topic in the form of many different points of views all together, through the concept of simultaneity of movement, also with a focus on memory. So those developments cannot be thought of independently. This is one issue. I mean, in my dissertation, which is something very different because I was working mainly on space, what I was trying to work through was a way in which an interest for the representation of space in the novels of Virginia Woolf and in the poetry of Mina Loy was somehow connected with the way in which space functioned in psychological theory, in psychoanalysis, and also in painting, as a way of talking about the self. Currently, I'm working on a monograph on Mina Loy, and it will be focused on her work as a sort of corpus that engages critically with the idea of art. So with the concept of genius, with the idea of the notion of an art object, so what an art object is, what it should be, what it should do. So as you see, I'm still moving within this larger and broader interdisciplinary context. But so that's sort of, that's still a spin-off from my PhD, even though I moved in a different direction. My other works were usually born out of conversations with colleagues. So I co-edited a book on museums and literature, museums, collections and literature, which was born out of a conference panel that I organized with my former professor in Milan, Caroline Pate, and it was incredibly productive and it was an eye-opener to think of the connection between literature and museums and collections. In, of course, the key issue was, well, the key issues were that of the objects, but also the very idea of a discipline. So we asked ourselves the question of, after establishing that in various ways, many literary authors, many major literary authors, such as Henry James, for example, responded in their work to the success of museums as places to communicate culture, but also to actually make meaning, in sort of turn history into an object that can be accessed, and turn nature into something that can be accessed easily. So we asked ourselves whether there was a deep connection between the emergence of what one might call culture of the museum. So the idea that, you know, out of a collection that is more or less an erratic gathering of objects that depends more on the taste or the will of a single person. So moving from there to the idea of a museum, which is informed by the idea that there is one way of arranging those objects that creates a narrative about their either provenance or meaning or history, or that in turn a sequence of objects organized by a narrative may say something about a country. So what was the literary response, whether literature was informed by this, by that system? And we all together realized that, in fact, it was a very interesting way of thinking about literary works. So some people worked on ideas of collection of words. Other people worked on the connection between autobiography and collecting, like me. Other people worked on the sheer representation of objects, objects in museums, and the aesthetic experience of spectatorship, and so on. And so that's where the book, that's the origin of that book, and it still stays with me. I taught here at Bard Berlin a few courses that related directly to that research, and one of them was a course on museums, literature, and collections that made great use of the museums here in Berlin. And I mean, this is the perfect place to teach a course like that. The other book is, which I co-edited with Sara Fortuna, a great friend and colleague from Rome, who's a philosopher of language, was on Dogville. As you see, my research is pretty erratic because I get carried away by interesting ideas. So I couldn't fit in any department. And that, again, was based on an ongoing conversation that Sara and I had, because we both enjoyed Lars von Trier's movies, but we're both very interested in feminism and gender theory, and we were very disturbed by what Lars von Trier's movies did to our thinking, I guess. And of course, personally too, because there are films that really disturb one. Actually, when we asked a colleague in the USA to contribute to the book, she's a famous feminist scholar, and she replied to us, Lars von Trier should stop making masterpieces. And I don't want to write about them because they're too disturbing. Anyway, so we started talking about Dogville, and we realized that coming from very different fields, she's a philosopher of language, that we both use Dogville in our courses. I, at the time, was teaching here a course on gender theory. And she was teaching a course, I can't remember. Anyway, so we both used Dogville to teach different courses, very different topics. And it emerged that other colleagues were using Dogville to teach yet other courses on very different topics again. So we realized that this was one of those objects that are so powerful that open up a Pandora's box, that disturb, and that these disturbances help us asking better questions about other things that the film skirts on even or thematizes properly. And so that's why we did the book. So the class I'm teaching now, I am co-teaching now with James Harker. Basically, one half of the course, and they run in parallel, these two halves, one half of the course is focused on canonical texts in modernist literature and art and philosophy. And the philosophical texts focus mostly on time or even if they don't, we read them in relation to new ways of thinking about time. All these texts are read in dialogue with one another. So it is a class that is ongoing, so the texts read at the very beginning of the class don't disappear. So they reappear in various moments. And it's a course that is based on the idea that, again, that we can, that philosophical, literary, artistic, and scientific texts in this precise period are concerned in various ways with the idea of time, and that these ideas circulate in the larger, broader European and also American context. The second half is focused on The Man Without Qualities, Musil's masterpiece. And on the one hand, it is also a course on its own, because we very much, we pay much attention to close reading of the text, to its specific context, to its relationship with contemporary Austrian literature or German-speaking literature and art. But eventually what happens is that we always try and institute a dialogue with the texts we've read in the beginning of the week. When I came here 18 years ago, it wasn't my first encounter with the city. I actually rushed to Berlin as soon as the wall came down. That's the experience that's the founding experience for me, because that's where I decided I wanted to live in this city anyway. And I came 6 years after that to live here. Well, of course, the city has changed, and I think it was Tucholsky who said at the beginning of the 20th century that the essence of Berlin was that it kept on changing anyway. It has changed, but I've changed too. So it is very hard to give an objective picture of how the city has changed. Certainly, when I arrived, the city was bankrupt. it was very, it was full of energy, creative energy, but it was effectively very poor, as Vovereit used to say, poor and sexy. That's exactly how it was. It was ugly, but beautiful, in the sense that it was, parts of it were still in ruins, and you could tell that the people had lived for decades in sort of partial isolation in one way or another. So, and when I lived in the first 2 years, I also was, I guess, poor and sexy. I had no money, and I was very young. So I lived the city in those terms. And I guess the city for me has evolved as my life has evolved. It's grown up. And now I wouldn't say it is like any other city in Europe, but it's going there. And I mean, it's still much cheaper than anywhere in Europe, and especially a capital. It's still very interesting in the sense that a city with three opera houses, lots of money devoted to culture, lots of interest for culture, from subculture to high culture. That I think it's incredible power. I mean, you could say that for any metropolis, of course, but I guess the percentage of the people who are interested in producing culture in Berlin, with respect to the whole population of the city, is very high. I guess that's felt, and yes, it you can use it as a metropolis, but you can also leave it as a village.